From To the Best of Our Knowledge and Public Radio International, a special series called Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, the modern classic.
Less than 6 inches from me, and my burning life was nebulous Lolita.
A reading from one of the most reviled and revered books of all time. Today we'll get to know the modern classic, from Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita to the best-selling book of all time in Sweden, a coming-of-age novel called Popular Music from Vitula. Also, an English professor reads the forbidden Western canon in Tehran.
Once I gave a talk on modern novel at Tehran Book Fair, and it became so crowded that the security had to shut it down. It was almost like a riot.
Sometimes you have to wait decades to identify a classic. Sometimes it's a little easier than that. Popular Music from Vitula is the best-selling book in Swedish history. It is the poignant coming-of-age story of two boys, Matti and Nila, growing up in a far northern Swedish town. Popular Music from Vitula was written by Mikael Naimi. Steve Paulson talked with him in between breaks for a bite of reindeer meat.
I wrote this book for my people. I'm living there and there are very few books written about us. So I wanted to do this for my people, to show us ourselves that we exist and to describe us.
And the people you describe in the book are, they're not pretty.
No.
They're not good-looking people. They're kind of dirty. They drink a lot. They drink too much. The male culture gets pretty rough. There are a lot of fights going on. Is this the way it really is?
Well, look at me. Well, yes, it's like that. It's I wanted to do an honest book. I didn't want to lie and make people prettier than they were. And also, we are quite proud of being a little bit more wild than the rest of the Swedish people. It's a little bit of a mentality up there.
Now, the story is told by the narrator, Matti, who is reflecting back on his childhood experiences once he's grown up. And it seems that for him, it was pretty important to leave Pajala. I mean, he wanted to get out of this place. And you have a passage where you get at this, why a boy would want to get away. And I'm wondering if you could read that for us.
Mm. Det var en uppväxt av brist. Inte en materiell sådan. Det hade vi så vi klarade oss. Utan en identitetsmässig.
Ours was a childhood of deprivation.
Våra föräldrar var
not material deprivation. We had enough to get by on. But a lack of identity. We were nobody. Our parents were nobody. Our forefathers had made no mark whatsoever on Swedish history. Our last names were unspellable, not to mention being unpronounceable, for the few substitute teachers who found their way up north from the real Sweden. Our school exam results were the worst in the whole country. We had no table manners. We wore woolly hats indoors. We never picked mushrooms, avoided vegetables. We were useless at conversation, reciting poems, wrapping presents, and giving speeches. We walked with our toes turned out. We spoke with a Finnish accent without being Finnish, and we spoke with a Swedish accent without being Swedish. We were nothing. There was only one way out, only one possibility if you wanted to be something. No matter how insignificant, you had to live somewhere else.
Om så det allra minsta, nämligen att flytta.
But you still live in Pajala. Why?
Well, for me, it's my roots. I was born there, and I think every child gets very influenced by the surroundings. I mean, the smell of the air, the feeling of a landscape around you. It's like a mystery. I think it's a beauty. It's very nice.
Hmm. Now, the core of this novel, Popular Music from Vitula, is the friendship between two boys, Matti and Nila. How did these two meet?
Yes, they meet outside in Pajala on a playing ground, and they become friends and start to play with each other, and they are followed up through the years until they're teenage. And it's about their life. it's not a complicated story. I mean, these books have been written many, many times. But two boys growing up, what happens? They meet girls or they don't meet girls. They fight sometime. They have their first sip of alcohol and they find rock and roll music. Many books is written in this way, but no one from Pajala. And that's maybe what makes it a bit special. It's from the very, very far north of the world.
You have a wonderful passage where you get at not only what life was like for these two boys, but their own growing intimacy with each other. And I'm wondering if you could read that.
Yeah. En härlig kväll klev vi in i syrrans rum utan att knacka, sen mamma och pappa åkt på bilbingo på fotbollsplanen. Brudarna skrek till.
One weekend night, when mom and dad had gone off to play car bingo at the local football ground, we marched into Sis's room without knocking. The girls screamed. There was a crate of beer in the middle of the floor. We backed out, but Sis dragged us in and locked the door. I played the idiot in order to save my life and muttered something about how they were free to drink as much Tizer as they liked. Then the girls all burst out laughing, and one of them said we had to taste a drop as well, so that we were just as guilty as they were. She opened a bottle and came up close, and I felt her permanent wave on my cheek and her hairspray in my nostrils and her warm breath all over my face. She took hold of me by the cheeks quite firmly, while another girl held the bottle over my mouth, and I opened it wide. I lay back and gazed up into the girl's beautifully painted eyes. Oh, they were as blue as the river. She must have been at least 14. And she looked down at me so warmly, so tenderly. I wanted to stay there for the rest of my life, fall asleep in her embrace. She zoomed in on me with her lipstick lips, and then she kissed me. The girls all cheered. I felt dizzy and propped myself up against the wall. Nila was forced to drink the rest of the bottle. He did his best and was rewarded with applause. Afterward, we found ourselves standing in the yard, shivering. "What did she do?" he whispered. I grabbed him by the shoulders. "Stick out your tongue," I said. "No, no, not as much as that." He pulled it back in so that just the tip was sticking out, round and wet and pink. I stuck mine out as well. We stood there without moving for a while, and then I leaned forward and kissed his salty, boyish mouth.
En stund stod vi så helt stilla. Sen lutade jag mig fram och kysste hans salta pojkmun.
Now, one thing that happens in the story is northern Sweden discovers rock and roll and the things that go along with it, like sex and drugs. When did that happen for you?
My father, he was working, his family was working with forest things. They were hunting and fishing, and they had a very small farm with cows. And he went into school for only 7 years, and after that, when he was 13, he started to work as a grown-up. They didn't have a teenage period. They were children and then they were adults at once. So we were the first generation who had some period in between children and adults. It was the whole society changed into what we have now. And I was one of the first in my area who experienced that. And it's so interesting. It's beautiful. And we felt the power of rock and roll and music. And our parents didn't. And we love that.
Mikael Naimi is the author of the novel called Popular Music from Vittula. Steve Paulson spoke with him. The readings from the book were by Carl Schmidt. Like Popular Music from Vittula, the best-selling novel, The Kite Runner, brings to life places and people most Americans know little about. The novel delves into the recent history of Afghanistan, going back to the peaceful years before the Soviet invasion, then plunging into the more recent chaos. The author, Khalad Hosseini, was born in Afghanistan and now lives in California.
His novel's partly autobiographical. One of the early scenes comes right out of Hosseini's childhood, when he used to watch kites battling in the sky above him. Here's an excerpt from the book.
At least 24 kites already hung in the sky, like paper sharks roaming for prey. Within an hour, the number doubled, and red, blue, and yellow kites glided and spun in the sky. A cold breeze wafted through my hair. The wind was perfect for kite flying, blowing just hard enough to give some lift, make the sweeps easier. Next to me, Hassan held the spool, his hands already bloodied by the string. Soon the cutting started, and the first of the defeated kites whirled out of control. They fell from the sky like shooting stars with brilliant, rippling tails, showering the neighborhoods below with prizes for the kite runners. They were coming down all over the place now, the kites, and I was still flying. I was still flying. A red kite was closing in on me, and I'd caught it just in time. I tangled a bit with it and ended up besting him when he became impatient and tried to cut me from below.
That's very nice. I want you to tell me a little bit more about the kites. This is not kite flying the way we understand it in the States. It appears to be a good deal more than going out on a windy afternoon with a piece of paper on some sticks with some string.
Yeah, the kite flying in Afghanistan is not purely for a leisurely thing. It's really a sport. The way it was played was that the string was rolled in a thick mixture of finely ground glass and glue. And so the string became very, very sharp. And in essence, it became a weapon. And then you used your string during a tournament to sever the other guy's line. And the objective was to be the final remaining kite in the sky. And the other side of the coin was when the kite was cut, then the kids on the street would go chasing after it. And because these battles took place way up in the sky, sometimes a kite could drift across entire neighborhoods and kid would chase it until it came down on a rooftop or a treetop or something. And then when you had it, it was kind of a trophy, a bit like catching a foul ball at a baseball game. And so I coined the phrase the kite runners for those boys who chased after the felled kites and tried to catch it as it came down.
Now, this story takes place at a time in Afghanistan that, a little like the kite flying, is a time we don't entirely know in the United States. This is Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. It was a very different country then from the kind of place it is now?
It really was. The first third of the kite runners set in really the Afghanistan of my childhood, the late 60s and the mid-1970s. And it is a forgotten era in the country's history. It seems like Afghanistan for a long time has become synonymous with the Soviet war and with opium and the Taliban and al-Qaeda. But it used to be a good place to live. And for most of the 20th century, Afghanistan existed in peaceful anonymity. I remember coming to Paris. My family moved from Afghanistan in 1976. And people would ask me where I was from, and I would say Afghanistan. And nobody knew where it was, and they couldn't point it out on a map. Of course, those days are gone too now.
You were a diplomat's son, and in Paris, remembering where you had come from during the time when the government was changing in Afghanistan?
Yeah, the monarchy ended in 73 in a bloodless coup, and the king's cousin overtook the country in 1973, and my family moved to Paris in 1976. My father was assigned to a diplomatic post in the Afghan embassy in Paris. And so that's how I, very fortuitously as it turned out, left Afghanistan, because within 2 years, the communist coup d'etat happened, and then the Soviets invaded, and I was very fortunate to be out of Afghanistan when those events happened.
It has to have been a frightening time for you and your family, I should think, because your father was attached to the old government, the one that had been overthrown. You were young enough not to have any influence over that, but for him, I suppose there must have been the question of whether he should go back or whether to stay away.
There was no way he was going back. Both for reasons of safety, because a couple of his colleagues from the old regime, when their term expired, went back. And unfortunately, we heard very soon that they had been executed. And so there was that fear. And also for ideological reasons, my father did not want to work with a communist party in Afghanistan. And so I remember those years in Paris when our future was uncertain as a kind of a time of intrigue. And I remember my father, in retrospect, I remember he had made secret plans for us to come to the U.S., but when we would go someplace, he would insist that everybody wait by the door, and then he would go to the garage and turn on the car for fear that perhaps a bomb had been placed. So it kind of felt like you were living in a little bit of a Jean Le Carré espionage book.
Yeah.
So I that's sort of how I remember those days.
What do you think now of the future of Afghanistan from what you've seen and from what you remember of what it used to be?
Well, you know, it sort of depends whether you look at the situation optimistically or pessimistically. You can say Afghanistan is really a disaster. The government still doesn't have much viability outside the boundaries of Kabul. The warlords really are running the show in the provinces where all the action is. The opium trade is out of control, and Afghanistan's sort of on the verge of becoming one of these narco states. And, you know, the Taliban are making a comeback along with the Al-Qaeda in the south and the east of the country, and there's these constant skirmishes. Or you could say, look, the economy is slowly recovering. Roads are being built again. There's a national currency. The government is beginning to impose itself. An army is being built. And a constitution has been approved that lays the foundation for, you know, a nascent democracy of sorts. And so there's reason for optimism as well. And as always, the truth is in either extreme. It's probably somewhere in the middle. And so I think it's very soon, only 2 or 3 years after liberation, and Afghanistan is, you know, a work in progress.
Khaled Hosseini, author of the novel The Kite Runner. Hosseini now lives in California, where he practices medicine when he's not writing. Coming up, it's been called vile, perverted, and exquisite. We'll find out why Lolita still matters. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, The Modern Classic, part of the special series Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books, presented by, to the best of our knowledge, and PRI, Public Radio International. Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita is now more than 50 years old, one of the most celebrated and notorious novels ever written. It's the story of a middle-aged man's sexual obsession with a 12-year-old girl. The novel was first published by a small press in Paris. It was so controversial that no American publisher would touch it for several years. Today, Lolita's considered a masterpiece. Steve Paulson talked with some well-known writers and editors about the novel's enduring influence.
Lolita is a novel that grabs you from the very first words.
Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita.
That's novelist Amy Tan reading the beginning of Lolita.
It is so full of music and immediately seizes you with the sense of a voice and its sensuality. It's as though it is caviar in each single sentence. It is so dense, and yet it's very light at the same time.
Lolita is widely admired by contemporary writers. Many have read it over and over. In fact, a jury of distinguished authors recently ranked it the fourth best novel of the 20th century. And despite the controversy over its pedophilia, for many, Lolita remains the gold standard for sheer brilliance and lyricism in fiction. Novelist Donna Tartt considers Nabokov the godlike master of her craft.
I just hold him in absolutely the highest reverence. He's the anthropomorphic deity that presides over my own kind of Mount Olympus.
Deborah Treisman, the fiction editor of The New Yorker, actually calls Lolita a perfect novel.
I read it probably 5 times in college. Even today, I opened it up again, and there were passages that I knew off by heart and that would bring me to tears.
This sort of accolade is remarkable, considering the scandal that Lolita generated when it first came out in 1955. What really set people off then was the novel's charming and lecherous narrator, Humbert Humbert, the decadent European who's come to America to prey on young girls. Here's an excerpt read by Jeremy Irons.
Less than 6 inches from me, and my burning life was nebulous Lolita. After a long, stirless vigil, my tentacles moved towards her again, and this time the creak of the mattress did not awake her. I managed to bring my ravenous bulk so close to her that I felt the aura of her bare shoulder like a warm breath upon my cheek.
Donna Tartt first heard about Lolita when she was a teenager. The book wasn't in her library, so she went looking to buy a copy.
I went to the mall with some friends of mine, and they had it in the bookshop, but I was embarrassed to buy the book because of its cover. It was this cheesy, soft porn kind of Boogie Nights kind of cover, and I thought, oh, no. And I didn't even have very much money, but I bought another book, so, you know, my friend's father wouldn't think I was buying some sort of porno novel.
It isn't a sexy read. I looked at it hoping it would be when I was about 15 and soon ran out of interest. It's not some exquisite bit of erotica.
That's British novelist Martin Amis. Humbert tells the story as though he's confessing to his crimes, but for much of the book he revels in his lust for this 12-year-old girl.
Gentlewomen of the jury, bear with me. Allow me to take just a tiny bit of your precious time. So this was le grand moment. I had left my Lolita still sitting on the edge of the abysmal bed.
The novel is also a labyrinthian puzzle, with clues dropped in throughout about how Lolita will eventually escape Humbert. But above all, it's a dazzling display of the English language, all the more remarkable since Nabokov was a Russian emigre. The author even coined new words, most famously nymphette, to describe the rather naughty Lolita.
Can we stop at a gas station?
We can go anywhere you like.
Well, I need a gas station. I heard inside. Well, what'd you expect? I was a daisy fresh girl, and look what you've done to me. I should call the police and tell them that you raped me, you dirty old man.
That's a scene from Adrian Lyne's film adaptation of Lolita, starring Jeremy Irons and Dominique Swain. Over the years, the novel's lofty reputation and racy story have enticed various filmmakers, but putting Lolita on the screen has challenged even the best writers. Lyne rejected scripts by Harold Pinter and David Mamet before taking Stephen Schiff's screenplay. The task for Schiff was daunting. How do you adapt a novel that's all about language and so completely in the head of the narrator?
One thing I realized was that there was a surprisingly small amount of dialogue in it, and what was there is not something that in the mouths of an actor is going to really translate well to the screen. So what I really had to do was kind of rewrite Nabokov, which is... you know, a crazy thing to be doing.
And Stephen Schiff had another challenge, making the audience care about a monster like Humbert.
One of the great things that art can aspire to is to bring the audience into an intimacy and a sympathy with a character whose deeds we nevertheless condemn. You can love Humbert and still hate what he does.
A normal man, given a group photograph of schoolgirls, and asked to point out the loveliest one, will not necessarily choose the nymphette among them. You have to be an artist, a madman, full of shame and melancholy and despair, in order to recognize the little deadly demon among the others.
The novel's moral ambiguity is part of its brilliance, and one reason Lolita still feels so contemporary. Nabokov himself dismissed any moral reading, saying all he cared about was aesthetic bliss. But the New Yorker's Deborah Treisman says the genius of Lolita is how it moves from comedy to tragedy, to a shattering moment when Humbert finally admits that he's ruined Lolita's life.
What happens is you have all of this ornate and comic buildup, and you think you're reading one kind of a novel, and then you get towards the end, at which point the raw emotion breaks through.
Reader, what I heard was but the melody of children at play, nothing but that.
By this time, Humbert has lost Lolita. He stops by the side of the road and hears the voices of children in a town below.
I stood listening to that musical vibration from my lofty slope, to those flashes of separate cries with a kind of demure murmur for background, and then I knew that the hopelessly poignant thing was not Lolita's absence from my side, but the absence of her voice from that concord.
It's the moment at which he actually is able to come clean about what has happened and that he's taken this girl's childhood.
Martin Amis agrees.
What he has done, he's murdered her soul. He has detached her from the human race.
For all its acclaim, Lolita occupies an odd place in American literature. Many writers call it their favorite novel, and yet its influence is hard to gauge. Lolita is so distinctive, so complete, that it stands alone. Amy Tan says Nabokov is one writer you cannot possibly imitate.
Nabokov is somebody whose work you read, and if you're the sort of very insecure writer, we'd say, well, I might as well not even try to write, because he's just so brilliant and clever and beautiful and nasty.
A new paperback edition of Lolita has just been published by Vintage. Steve Paulson produced our story about Lolita.
This, then, is my story. I have reread it. It has bits of marrow sticking to it and blood and beautiful bright green flies. At this or that twist of it, I feel my slippery self eluding me, gliding into deeper and darker waters than I care to probe. I have camouflaged what I could so as not to hurt people. And I've toyed with many pseudonyms for myself before I hit on a particularly apt one. There are in my notes Otto Otto and Mesmer Mesmer and Lambert Lambert. But for some reason, I think my choice expresses the nastiness best. When I started 56 days ago to write Lolita, first in the psychopathic ward for observation and then in this well-heated, albeit tumult, seclusion, I thought I would use these notes in toto at my trial, to save not my head, of course, but my soul. In mid-composition, however, I realized that I could not parade living Lolita. I may still use parts of this memoir in hermetic sessions, but publication is to be deferred.
Steve Paulson prepared that piece on Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. You wouldn't think the novel Lolita would go over big in an underground women's book group in Tehran, but literature, like the people who read it, has a way of surprising you. Azar Nafisi is an English professor and the author of the memoir Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her book tells the story of her life as an English professor in revolutionary Iran. Nafisi taught at the University of Tehran until she was expelled for refusing to wear a veil. But her passion for literature still burned. She gathered seven of her former students together in her home every week to talk about the forbidden classics of Western literature. Steve Paulson asked her about the first time the group met.
It was like, you know, thinking that you're in love, but you're not sure. I mean, I had dreamt of having a class like this for so long, and now that it was about to be actualized, I was both worried about how they will react to one another, how they will react to the books we're reading, will they come to the next session, and at the same time, I was full of hope. So I prepared for it the way you would prepare for going to your first date.
You read some pretty racy stuff, especially Lolita. I mean, this Nabokov story of this 12-year-old girl who gets seduced by this very urbane but smarmy man who is her guardian. That must have been pushing the edge a little bit.
Well, actually, it is amazing with Nabokov. And one reason was that Nabokov himself had gone through that experience of totalitarianism. Although he left the Soviet Union when he was 19, he was obsessed with it. Now, the story of Lolita, as we read it, was not just the rape of a 12-year-old girl, but the fact that Nabokov chooses a narrator and a seducer who is not, you know, who on the first impression, you, the reader, are seduced by him because he rapes Lolita more than seduce him. But we are seduced because he's a poet. He's a sophisticated man. And he justifies keeping Lolita in his jail almost for 2 years and raping her and, you know, having sexual intercourse with her against her will by saying that she was vulgar and that she seduced him. The point of Nabokov here is that the biggest crime is to impose your own dream, because Humbert had been in love with a girl in his childhood when he was 13, and he was trying to resurrect that girl through Lolita. The whole point of the book is that you cannot impose figments of your imagination on other people's lives, no matter how vulgar or mundane their lives might seem to you. And this is exactly what the Islamic Republic did to us. They imposed the figments of their imagination on us, saying that wearing lipstick was a crime. Now, we might like or dislike wearing lipstick, but no state can impose its own image of what I should be on me. And that is, I think, the point of Lolita. Nabokov was, I think, one of the most popular writers we read.
Now, one thing that strikes me as you're describing this experience is how intense it was. And I would guess far more intense than what you'd get in a typical English class in America, where theoretically anything goes. I mean, you can say whatever you want in the class, but somehow it's just not going to be as loaded or as vital as it sounds like it was in your home in Tehran.
Well, you know, not just in my home. I had this experience also when I was teaching at universities in Iran. There was a degree of intensity and eagerness to their students' reaction to these books that I never found in U.S. And I think that their own experiences of life over there, being deprived of the most basic rights, of the most individual rights, made them so sensitive to these works, which opened a new window towards beauty and individual dignity and choice. Just the fact that an individual could write the way Shakespeare can or the way Nabokov did, I think, is a miracle in itself. And my students in Iran felt that miracle. Once I gave a talk on modern novel at Tehran Book Fair, and it became so crowded that the security had to shut it down. It was almost like a riot, you know. Where else in the world today can you give a talk about modern novel or Madame Bovary and have people up in arms, you know? So it was an exciting experience.
You tell some remarkable stories, both about what happened in this private underground group in your home, but also about some of your experiences at the university. For instance, how Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby ended up on trial in your class. Can you explain what happened?
Well, that was during my salad years, actually, my first year of teaching at the University of Tehran. I was soon expelled because I refused to wear the veil that they meant mandatory. And I was teaching a book on great works of fiction, 20th century fiction. And actually, I was trying to be very fair. Along with Fitzgerald, I had people whom I really didn't like Maxim Gorky, even the Marxist Russian writer. But one day, one of the leaders of the Muslim Student Association, he stopped me in the hall and he told me how he hated Gatsby. And he went on ranting and raving about the immorality and decadence of Gatsby, and that we had just had a revolution in order to wipe these people out, and I was bringing them back. And I thought that, well, I was not about to give in to his demand, but I wanted also to not just use my authority as a teacher and say, no, you know, I'm going to teach Great Gatsby no matter what you say. At that time, we still had some liberties which were soon taken away from us during the Cultural Revolution. So I decided that I will give him a chance to bring this to the class, and I decided that we'll put Great Gatsby on trial. And he became the prosecutor, and a wonderful, yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, he was in such an awkward position, you know, because he didn't expect this. But now he had to become the prosecutor, and one of my wonderful girls, whom I never saw after that year, she became the defense, and the class forced me to become the book. The defense. They said, you chose it, so you'll become the defense. And which we put Great Gatsby on trial.
So how did that work? how did the case for the prosecution proceed?
Well, I mean, I know I'm biased, but I really, he ranted and raved. And basically he was saying that Gatsby was propagating an adulterous relationship, and that was immoral, and that was a sign of American decadence. And also the fact that he kept saying, and one other student whom we had asked to be the judge kept saying that Fitzgerald loved the wealthy and he liked the rich people and he was against the oppressed. And the argument against it was that a great book goes sometimes even against the desires and aspirations of its own author. And no matter how much Fitzgerald in his own life might have loved wealth, in The Great Gatsby, the biggest villains in the book are Tom and Daisy Buchanan because they're careless people. Because they force others to clean up after the mess they make. And this is the essence of The Great Gatsby.
So how did that episode end in your class? How did the trial of The Great Gatsby end?
Well, first of all, it became really heated. I mean, I gave them the defense and the prosecution kept interrupting one another. And, you know, it became a shouting match. And I gave them a break. And I remember when I came in, they were still at it. And the girl was saying that, you know, you don't understand. I don't remember exact words, anything about freedom, because you call me a whore. And he was really mad. But what she was saying was true, because they were saying that any woman who did not dress or who did not act according to their dictates was a prostitute, was spreading prostitution. And others got involved in the story. And at the end of the class, she got up and she said that the most important thing she got from Great Gatsby was the pleasure of reading The Great Gatsby. And isn't that enough? And she asked the question whether when we read Moby Dick, do we go whaling? And when we read Great Gatsby, do we all run and become adulterers? That this is not the point of a great book, that it creates a dimension in us, creates a space in us that we've never had before. And in my book, I wanted to end that session with what she said, which has remained with me for such a long time.
Today, Azza Nafisi teaches literature at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of the memoir Reading Lolita in Tehran. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Is Lolita trash or treasure? Let us know what you think. Send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, the joy of rereading the classics and best-selling author Jane Hamilton on the best ending in the modern canon. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, The Modern Classic. It's part of the special series Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books, presented by, to the best of our knowledge, and PRI, Public Radio International. From one of the most important Italian writers of all time, here's a reading from If on a Winter Night a Traveler by modern novelist Italo Calvino.
You are about to begin reading Italo Calvino's new novel, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. Relax. Concentrate. Dispel every other thought. Let the world around you fade. Best to close the door. The TV is always on in the other room. Tell the others right away, no, I don't want to watch TV. Raise your voice. They won't hear you otherwise. I'm reading. I don't want to be disturbed. Maybe they haven't heard you with all the racket. Speak louder. Yell. I'm beginning to read Italo Calvino's new novel. Or, if you prefer, don't say anything, and just hope they'll leave you alone. Well, what are you waiting for? Stretch your legs. Go ahead. Put your feet up on the cushion, on two cushions, on the arms of a sofa, on the wings of a chair, on the coffee table, on the desk, on the piano, on the globe. Take your shoes off first. If you want, put your feet up. If not, put them back. Now, don't stand there with your shoes in one hand and your book in the other. Adjust the light so you won't strain your eyes. Do it now, because once you're absorbed in reading, there will be no budging you. Make sure the page isn't in shadow. a clotting of black letters on a gray background, uniform as a pack of mice. But be careful the light cast isn't too strong, doesn't glare on the cruel of the white paper, gnawing at the shadows of the letters as in a southern noonday. Try to see everything that might interrupt your reading. Cigarettes within reach, if you smoke, and the ashtray. Anything else? Do you have to pee? All right, you know best. It's not like you expect anything particular from this particular book. You are the sort of person that, on principle, no longer expects anything of anything. There are plenty younger than you, or less young, who live in the expectation of extraordinary experiences, from books, from people, from journeys, from events, from what tomorrow has in store. But not you. You know, the best you can expect is to avoid the worst.
Gene Ferracca, reading from Italo Calvino's novel, If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. Anne Fadiman is the editor of a book called Rereadings, 17 Writers Revisit Books They Love. Fadiman talked to Anne Strainchamps about rereading classic books, both personal classics and cultural classics.
You cannot read a classic without rereading. If one thinks of timelessness as being the most important characteristic of a classic, those layers have to be peeled back many, 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 many times in order to decide whether there are any layers still there to peel. If you feel you've gotten to the bottom in the first 20 years of a book's existence on the planet, it can't possibly be a classic.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of your own personal experiences of rereadings. There's a story you tell in the introduction to the book about rereading one of the C.S. Lewis Narnia stories.
Yes, it was one of the less well-known Narnia books called The Horse and His Boy, and I hadn't reread it since I was 8. And I was reading it aloud to my own son, who was 8 at the time. And I realized to my consternation that this book that I had absolutely loved as a child revealed that its author was a racist and sexist pig. All the villains had dark skin. All the girls were either idiots or boy-like, and I didn't know whether to editorialize and say, Henry, have you noticed a few things about this? And I started along that road, and Henry just glared at me and said, Mommy, would you just read? And I thought that that was an excellent piece of literary criticism on his part, because when you read a book for the first time in that first ecstasy of love, you don't want to be analytical. You don't want to be cynical. You just want to rush forward in rapture. And I decided it would be better if I didn't interrupt Henry's rapturous journey. So I did just read.
Sometimes I think there are readers who read to lose themselves and to go someplace brand new, readers who really enjoy the feeling of being surprised, overwhelmed even. And then there are readers like me who read for comfort. And I've always felt a bit guilty, thinking that, you know, if I were a real reader, a good reader, I would enjoy that feeling of surprise and discovery. But in fact, what I really love best is reading something that makes me feel comfortable and safe. And so I suppose that's why I really do reread a great many books. There's some safety in knowing how things are going to turn out, that Jane Eyre gets the man in the end.
Yes, I think that that describes one very large category of books that are good to reread, particularly when our own lives are stressful and unpredictable and we don't know what's going to happen next, that rereading a book that we know extremely well gives us a sense of safety. For example, when we're sick, we often like to regress a bit and reread a book with a happy ending. And when you have a cold, you don't go out and try some spicy cuisine you've never hazarded before. You want chicken soup. But I don't think that that's the only category of books that are good to reread. I think that there are other books, let's say like War and Peace, that you simply can't get all of the first time. And if you reread War and Peace 10 times, you're still going to be peeling back an additional layer each time. And then there might be a book like Madame Bovary, or if we're sticking with Tolstoy, Anna Karenina, that you can't really understand until you've had the experience of erotic love. If you happen to be a precocious sort who reads one of those books at 14 and be considerably less precocious in your social life, you'd probably insist that you can understand them, but you really can't. You have to have been in love. You have to have felt the physical passion of love, I think, in order to understand the motivations of those characters. So you just need to have more life experience. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I don't think that comfort is the primary issue.
What's the best rereading experience you've ever had?
I think the best rereading experience I ever had was the reading of Lord of the Rings to my son. There's something about having first reading and rereading going on simultaneously that is absolutely magic. That is, you are doing the rereading while your child is in the ecstasy of first love. And first love, like all kinds of love, is more exciting than the latter varieties, because as readers, we've been so promiscuous over the years. If we haven't read very many books, each one is so exciting. And if we've loved only two or three, wow, that's really exciting. But after we've read and loved, you know, hundreds of books / lovers, well, they're not so exciting anymore. And so Henry was in that flush of first love while I was looking simultaneously at the book through a more distant lens. And it seemed like a journey, because it did take a year and a half to go from the beginning point to the end point.
Ann Fadiman is the editor of Rereadings, 17 Writers Revisit Books They Love. She spoke with Ann Strainchamps. As we come to the end of this hour, best-selling novelist Jane Hamilton shares some of her favorite endings from modern literature with Steve Balsam.
One of my favorite endings is All the King's Men, and it's by Robert Penn Warren, who now graces a postage stamp. You can go down to your post office and get them right now. This is a story about a hero and a heroine who have been childhood sweethearts. They grow up, they get involved with state politics, they are injured, they learn hard lessons, and then they get married. And this is the very end. So by next summer, we shall have left Burden's Landing. We shall come back, no doubt, to walk down the row and watch young people on the tennis courts by the clump of mimosas, and walk down the beach by the bay, where the diving floats lift gently in the sun, and on out to the pine grove, where the needles thick on the ground will deaden the footfall, so that we shall move among the trees as soundlessly as smoke. But that will be a long time from now, and soon now we shall go out of the house and go into the convulsion of the world, out of history, into history, and the awful responsibility of time.
Wow, that's terrific. Why do you like that so much?
Well, there's a category of endings, including Dear Reader, I Married Him. Then We Buried Hector. There's the teenage coming-of-age story where the narrator is older, wiser, and sadder. You know, those are a few. So in choosing my favorite ending, I had to choose the type of ending. And, you know, I'm still, even in middle age, fond of the marriage ending. But I like an ending to have a tinge of melancholy. And I think that the King's Men serves that purpose very well. The couple who have gotten married are older, sadder, wiser, middle-aged. They're broken. But it's a beautiful thing that they come together. And, you know, I suppose maybe by today's standards, this ending is a tiny bit sentimental, because there's the sense that there is providence in the fall of the sparrow, that everything we do matters, that we do have a responsibility to time. And that is, you know, kind of a terrifying reassurance.
Well, my sense also from the passage you just read is there's a sense of summing up of bigger ideas. I mean, it sort of it goes from the particular to something larger.
Yes, and it's always nice to have a little bit of nature in there, although I guess Elmer Leonard says never begin a book with nature. But a lot of endings do end with nature, as I was, you know, reading through this. I would have liked, in a way, to choose Dandelion Wine, because that is the ending in the category of the eulogy ending. The past is past. It's permanently over. It will never come again. But I couldn't read it without bawling, and I thought that would not be, a wise thing to do on the radio.
It could be kind of interesting. I don't know.
It's really sad. You know, he shuts his eyes, he goes to sleep, and thus endeth the summer of 1928 forever. It will never come back, ever.
Well, you actually did bring your copy. Could you read it for us?
Well, Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury is a recollection of a summer of boyhood. And during the course of it, he makes dandelion wine, which distills the summer for him. June dawns, July noons, August evenings over, finished, done, and gone forever, with only the sense of it all left here in his head. Now a whole autumn, a white winter, a cool and greening spring to figure sums and totals of summer past. And if he should forget, the dandelion wine stood in the cellar, numbered huge for each and every day. He would go there often, stare straight into the sun until he could stare no more, then close his eyes and consider the burned spots, the fleeting scars left dancing on his warm eyelids, arranging, rearranging each fire and reflection until the pattern was clear. So thinking, he slept, and, sleeping, put an end to summer 1928.
So why does that get to you so much?
Oh, there's just that elegiac sense that that beautiful time is forever past. And you can access it through the dandelion wine and memory, but you're growing old. You're going to die. It's over. That time will never come again.
Novelist Jane Hamilton on her favorite ending from Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine. Steve Paulson spoke with her. I'm Jim Fleming. You've been listening to The Modern Classic. It's part of the special series Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books. The series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, please go to our website at ttbook.org/greatbooks.
PRI, Public Radio International.